What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This episode is brought to you by ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. Enter ServiceNow. It puts AI to work for people, for employees, for developers, and even your customers, removing frustration and supercharging productivity. On our intelligent platform, AI isn't just a promise. It's happening today. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. To learn more, visit servicenow.com/AI for people.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to New Books in National Security. This is Paul, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Samantha Newbury, a lecturer in Contemporary Intelligence Studies at the University of Salford. She's also the author of Interrogation, Intelligence, and Security, Controversial British Techniques. The book is published by Manchester University Press. Hi, Samantha, and welcome to New Books in National Security. Happy to have you here to talk about the book.
Hi, thank you.
Perhaps you could start us off with a little bit just about yourself and how you came to the field of intelligence studies.
Okay, yeah. So I've been interested in intelligence studies really since I first went to university as an undergraduate student. Intelligence studies is quite a new discipline. It's only been around in any kind of real substantive form for, say, 30 years or so. And it addresses the hidden hand in history. So until the birth of intelligence studies, you could pick up any history book on the Second World War or any other more recent period, and intelligence would be missing. So it's very much been described as the hidden hand in history. It was there. It's informed policymakers' decisions, whether in government or in the military, but it hasn't been studied. It's been left out. So increasingly, it's been paid attention to now in history and also increasingly in political science as well. So that interest stayed with me. It led me to want to do a PhD in intelligence ethics, some aspect of the study of what is right when making decisions about what to do in intelligence. And what I hit upon was questions of interrogation techniques, which methods of collection for intelligence are right, which can be justified and appropriate in what circumstances. And that eventually grew into this book.
That also subsequently grew into your latest book, I believe. Was that Why Spy?
Yes, Why Spy came about when I interviewed my co-author on that, Brian Stewart, about the interrogation techniques. But the Why Spy book is a very broad book about intelligence studies, very much from my co-author's point of view. He had a long career in intelligence studies, in intelligence itself, working as an agent in Vietnam, China, and other places, as well as having a spell in the Cabinet Office as an intelligence officer. So that book, Why Spy, is very much a broad coverage of intelligence practice and lessons based on my co-author's experiences.
So, and I understand that Mr. Stewart passed away recently after a very amazing life and a really decorated career. So I'm really sorry for the loss of your friend as well.
Thank you. Thank you. He had a fascinating life, and there are some really appropriate obituaries out there that you can read online.
And he's Rory Stewart's father, is he not? Who's also had quite sort of an adventurous life and has written a number of books kind of touching on these areas.
Yes, Rory's written some really interesting books. I think most popular has been his book about when he walked across Afghanistan.
Yes.
That's a very good read, yeah.
It is. I enjoyed it. So how did you come to write interrogation, intelligence, and security? Did that just grow naturally out of your PhD dissertation?
Yes, it differs somewhat from the PhD. That focused on these particular interrogation techniques that the book is about, the five techniques, which we'll say more about shortly. But it focused on their use in Northern Ireland during the Troubles in the early 1970s, but also addressed other interrogation techniques and other what we can call mistreatment of prisoners in Northern Ireland in the early 1970s. Whereas the book focuses on the five techniques, and it doesn't just address the use of the five techniques of interrogation in Northern Ireland, but addresses them in other cases as well, specifically Aden in the 1960s and Iraq in 2003. So the idea of looking at three cases was to ask the same two fundamental questions of all of them. Firstly, how the techniques came to be used. And what were the results? Did they produce intelligence? Did they improve security? And what other results might have come about? And the reasons for focusing on the five techniques was very much the contemporary relevance. So when I started looking at them, as far as the public knew, the last time British forces used these interrogation techniques was 1971. And it then became clear that they'd been used in Iraq in 2003, soon after the coalition invaded there. And more broadly, the clear contemporary relevance of controversial interrogation techniques that might be described as torture, of course, has been a big issue since the start of the war on terror.
A perfect segue into the next question, which is just looking for some background exactly on what the so-called five techniques of interrogation are.
Of course, yeah. Before going into the kind of outline of the techniques, you can note that they haven't always been used as a group. Although they're referred to as the five, there have been cases when British forces have used them without using all five at once. And also the form that the five have taken do vary from case to case. But it is still possible to talk about them as a group and about what they entail. So they include deprivation of sight, usually by placing one or more hoods over somebody's head. The playing of white noise, generally at quite loud levels, to block out other sounds, and is a form of sensory deprivation. A stress position, which is a physically uncomfortable position, forced to be maintained for long periods of time. And also deprivation of sleep and a very limited diet. So in the Northern Ireland case, for instance, that was simply just dried bread and water offered every 6 hours.
To people who are familiar with the field will probably sound quite familiar. I don't imagine that these are uniquely British techniques by any means. I've heard of these being used, for example, by American interrogators in Afghanistan, by Israeli security services domestically, and a whole range of different services use these, I'm assuming.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're not unique to the British, but the way that they came about in the British context and the way that they did come to be regarded as a set that tended to be used together, it does mark them out from some of these other examples where similar techniques have been used by other forces.
Given that your work revolved around interrogation activities by British military and security services, how was this in terms of impacting your research? Did you have to rely heavily on the UK's access to information legislation, or was there a great deal that was already declassified and available to you?
The Freedom of Information Act has been hugely useful to people studying intelligence in particular. But in the case of these techniques, the vast majority of the material was already in the public domain. And that's because for all three of my case studies, Aden, Northern Ireland and Iraq, there were public inquiries into the use of these techniques. And that not only created a paper trail, but led that paper trail to be put into the public domain. So for the Aden and Northern Ireland cases, that's long enough ago that the material has made its way into the National Archives in London that anyone can access. And that's the kinds of records where you've got the Prime Minister's office communicating with the Foreign Office and the Ministry of Defence saying, what are we going to tell this inquiry? This inquiry wants to know how these techniques came about, how we invented them, what should we tell them? So we've got those records. And for the Iraq case, much more recently, following in line with the trend with very recent public inquiries in the UK, the material that they created and that they collected has been put online. Now, not all of it, because there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pages that they've created, but there are certainly thousands of pages on the website for the inquiry, which in this case was the Bahamusa inquiry. And that includes communications within the military from the time of the interrogations, emails between people in the military subsequently saying, okay, we realize these techniques were used, what are we going to do about it? But also material created by the inquiry itself. So that's the written witness statements that they create, that they collected from anybody who was involved in any way, and transcripts of the hearings. There were 115 days of hearings for the Bahamusa inquiry, and the transcripts of all of the cross-examination of every witness that went before the inquiry is available online.
Given that your work starts with the aid and emergency in the book, I think we'll start there. So some of our listeners, and I know I'm included in this, in terms of I was initially unfamiliar with the historical context of the aid and emergency. So perhaps you could just briefly outline the aid and emergency, and then how interrogation factored into the British colonial response.
The Aden case, the Aden emergency, was very much the latest in a long train of emergencies connected with the end of the British Empire. So Aden was a small territory, 73 square miles, and a very urban environment that had been a very important port for the British and was a major military base in the region as well. And there was a nationalist movement, a movement that wanted independence from Britain, as had also been seen in the other colonies, Malaya, for instance. This expressed itself with attacks, terrorist-style attacks, on members of the British military, the British police who were there, the British government and civil servants. There was an awful lot of grenades thrown at them, bombs planted, and even mortars fired. The real difficulty in Aden was that the locals were being intimidated by these insurgents or terrorists, depending on how you want to refer to them. So they weren't cooperating with the authorities. They were, well, a lot of them empathized with the insurgency anyway, but any who were perhaps on the fence were discouraged from telling the British authorities what they knew about who was in the insurgency, what their aims were, and so on, because of the strength and the intimidation being issued by the insurgent group. So it was difficult to gain intelligence. If you don't have the cooperation of the people, it's difficult to find out who's in the insurgency, what they want, where their bases are, and so on. So interrogation became a crucial source of intelligence in the Aden emergency. It produced intelligence that led to arrests and the seizure of weapons and arms, which, of course, helped the British there. But it was still a losing battle. In Aden. The High Commissioner, the British High Commissioner in Aden, has the series of High Commissioners stated just how important interrogation was. And that's very much clear from the records in the National Archives, that they emphasize the importance of intelligence and of interrogation as the main source of intelligence. And in doing so, they emphasized the importance of getting more resources, more interrogators from the British Army. It was very much the British military that were the experts in the five techniques and that took those five techniques to Aden and started using them there.
So it seems like this case perhaps differed from the case that you examine in Basra, Iraq, where the use of the five techniques seems to have been very controversial. At the time of the Aden emergency, were these techniques known back home in the UK that they were being applied? Was this causing controversy, or were we not even entering a period where this sort of activity would be controversial?
The treatment of prisoners in Aden was known about in the UK. Amnesty International, for instance, and the International Committee of the Red Cross in particular, were very concerned about the treatment of prisoners in Aden. But at the time, back in the UK, this treatment was being reported by the press, but there wasn't anywhere like the kind of concern that was seen when prisoners were being arguably mistreated in Northern Ireland, much closer to home, or in Iraq much more recently. And part of the reason for that is that Aden was perceived as being a long way from home. And it was a time when human rights were only really, they weren't as prominent, they weren't as well known or as much of a concern as they are today.
I think you alluded to this, but did the British deployment of the five techniques lead to actionable intelligence for British authorities in Aden?
I think that it did produce intelligence. There is a kind of a gap in the records in that we know the five techniques were used at the interrogation center in Aden, which was at Fort Morbet. And we know that intelligence was produced during that period, but we can't be absolutely certain that it was the use of the five techniques that created that intelligence. So we don't know whether the intelligence produced was a direct result of using the five techniques on, say, a particular individual who produced that intelligence. Rather, we know that the techniques were used during this period and that they were probably used on all of the prisoners, but we can't be sure. And we know that intelligence came out of the interrogation center at that time. So it seems that the techniques did help produce intelligence, but we can't be absolutely certain of the link and exactly what the nature of that link was.
Okay, moving on to 1969 to 1971, the Troubles in Ireland. What was the situation for the UK and in Ireland that led British authorities to introduce the five techniques there?
Well, yeah. So the Troubles, we say the Troubles began in Northern Ireland in 1969 because that's when the army was sent in. And we must remember, we take this for granted now, but how significant it was that the British army was sent on the streets within the United Kingdom to maintain law and order. And that was because the police force in Northern Ireland was simply not able to maintain order. So the Troubles began with civil rights protests, largely by the Catholic community, which led to violent clashes with police and with loyalist communities. So that's those communities who supported the British government and the British police. And that deteriorated to an extent that the army was sent in 1969. And at first, the locals welcomed the army. That was known as the honeymoon period. It was seen as an improvement. But the army quickly came to be seen as being biased against the Catholic community, which in turn incited the IRA to increase its campaign and further recruited people to the IRA. The major policy initiative of 1971 was the introduction of internment without trial, which bears similarities to what we see discussions taking place in connection with the war on terror about how long we should keep people imprisoned or detained without putting them on trial, simply because we suspect them of being involved in terrorism. So the introduction of internment without trial in August 1971 gave the opportunity for mass arrests, and it gave the opportunity to interrogate those people who were arrested for a long period of time, because if you're interning them without trial, you can hold them for a long period of time. And interrogation for intelligence was used on quite a wide scale under internment, for people arrested under internment, but the five techniques were used in a much more narrow kind of frame, with 12 of those men who were arrested on the first day of internment being subjected to the five techniques, and a further two men arrested in October of 1971 being interrogated that way.
So these 12 plus two, I understand, subjected to the five techniques because they were believed to be of a special intelligence value due to their connections in the IRA?
Yes, it was believed that they were all important members of the IRA and that would therefore produce intelligence. It has since been acknowledged by the authorities, the British authorities, and again, this is in the archives, that at least one of them was poorly selected and had no intelligence to give. But they also maintain that crucial life-saving intelligence was produced by this interrogation operation.
Mm-hmm. And what was the UK government's response, indeed the international response as well, to the interrogation activities that took place during the Troubles?
The UK's response, the UK responded to the widespread criticism that came out when it became known that the five techniques had been used. So when the first of the 12 men who were interrogated using the five techniques made it into the internment camps, so they were released from the interrogation center into internment, they were able to get a message out to the press about the techniques that they'd been exposed to. And that received widespread criticism in the press in the UK and internationally. The UK was forced to respond to that, that there were also all sorts of other allegations that came out of the introduction of internment, say that people were beaten when they were arrested, for instance. And that led to two public inquiries. First one was the Compton inquiry, which is connected to allegations of ill treatment. And that found that the five techniques had been used. But said that they weren't brutality, which I think many people then and now would contest. That then led on to the Parker inquiry, which looked into whether the interrogation techniques that had been used should continue to be used. And on balance of opinion of the Parker inquiry, the government decided to ban the five techniques from all future use. And the then Prime Minister stated in the House of Commons on the 2nd of March 1972 that the five techniques would be banned from all future use by British forces. That ban also then was contained in a new interrogation directive for forces. Internationally, the apart from the press criticism, the Republic of Ireland was the main source of criticism and more substantially of action. They took a case to the European Commission of Human Rights and then the European Court of Human Rights, alleging that the UK had breached various articles of the European Convention on Human Rights in Northern Ireland, including that the five techniques were torture. Now, in its 1978 ruling, the European Court of Human Rights found that the five techniques were in breach of the convention, but that they didn't quite meet the threshold for torture. But interestingly, this is now being contested. There are lawyers and the Republic of Ireland today acting on behalf of the surviving member of that group of members of that group of 14 who were exposed to the five techniques in Northern Ireland. And on the basis of the material in the National Archives in London, much of which informs the book, they are arguing that the British government withheld information from the European Court of Human Rights and that therefore the ruling that the techniques were not torture ought to be reconsidered. So the application to the European Court for them to reconsider that judgment has been put in and a response is being awaited.
Activity is having echoes still four decades later, it sounds like.
Absolutely, yeah.
Moving closer to the present day, were some of these historical lessons applied when the UK brought these interrogation measures into their occupying forces in Basra, Iraq, or were the old patterns just sort of repeated anew?
The techniques came to be used in Iraq in a very different way. So whilst they were an approved part of policy in all of the other cases, Aden, Northern Ireland, and those other conflicts connected with the end of empire that saw the techniques used. There they were used as a conscious decision that interrogation was needed and that the military should go in and bring those techniques and apply them. In Iraq, the techniques were used in a very narrow, but still, of course, controversial example in Basra, over a three-day period in September of 2003 in one building, a temporary detention facility. where a group of Iraqi civilians were being held on suspicion of being involved in terrorist activities. And there the techniques came to be used very much on an ad hoc kind of fashion. They were the idea of the soldiers who were there guarding supposedly looking after these detainees at the time. Some of the techniques were used because they were believed, these soldiers believed that they were necessary and required to prepare these detainees for questioning. And others, such as not being fed regularly, was simply just an oversight that they didn't do their job properly in looking after these prisoners. But in terms of applying lessons or not, that's where the Iraq case is particularly interesting, because another public inquiry was launched, which was very large and very expensive, into the claims that these techniques had been used there. And it was found that the 1972 ban, which had been contained in the new interrogation directive, so it said the techniques will not be used again. It found that the Ministry of Defense collectively as an institution had forgotten this ban, and that the ban had fallen out of all of the guidelines and directives for the military. So much like was the case in 1972, after 2003, there was another new interrogation directive containing the ban on the five techniques, and that ban was added back into training for members of the military who were going to be not only interrogating suspects, but handling detainees and looking after them, being responsible for detainees.
It was nowhere near sort of on the scale or level of intentionality as we might have seen in contrast with the U.S. forces in Iraq.
That's right, yeah. I mean, there were other interrogation operations and controversial techniques the UK were using in Iraq. But in, mm-hmm. in terms of these five techniques, they were used in this this isolated case for a whole combination of factors, including and as I say, a belief that they were going to be valuable for interrogation, but also this this absence of the ban from the literature and from the training that the soldiers involved had had. So it was a very different set of circumstances to the, to those cases where it was approved or required by policymakers, by military decision makers, and by the intelligence community.
And who was Baha Moussa? You made reference to the Baha Moussa inquiry earlier on in our discussion.
Yes, he was one of the detainees held and exposed to the five techniques in September of 2003. The reason the inquiry is named after him is that he lost his life as a result of his experiences at the hands of these British soldiers at this time. And the inquiry found that he lost his life as a combination of the use of the five techniques, which weakened him, and a beating that he sustained. A lot of the cases where these techniques and these kinds of techniques are used, there is physical beatings taking place as well. And in Baha Moussa's case, the combination of the five techniques and the beatings were found to have caused his death. And he was noted to have sustained 93 external injuries.
Charges ever pressed against anyone involved in that, or just the inquiry was the result?
There was a court martial, one of the soldiers involved became the UK's first convicted war criminal for his involvement in the treatment of Baha Moussa. So, but there has been criticism of the fact that more people have not been charged. And there have been some moves to re-examine that, given the evidence collected by the Baha Moussa inquiry. So we might hear more about that.
Moving to, I guess, a more general overview of the subject, what's your feeling on the overall utility of interrogation in intelligence, and that sliding scale of severity, and, you know, these situations where sometimes people refer to them as a ticking time bomb situation, where someone may have, as you alluded to in the Troubles, information that could stop attacks, for example. Just generally speaking, where has your research led you to sort of land on this topic?
Well, I think there is evidence to suggest that interrogation in general produces intelligence. I don't think that's likely to be contested by anyone. In terms of these kinds of controversial techniques, it's still difficult to say because the techniques differ from case to case and the impact that they have on an individual differs depending on that individual's mental state, their background, their health, and so on. And so it's difficult to speak even about the five techniques in general terms, but that there is evidence to suggest that these kinds of techniques might encourage the production of intelligence sometimes. But I think even then, the use of techniques that might be considered to be torture, I don't think they're ever justified. I think there's always another way to pursue intelligence.
Well, Samantha, you've been very generous with your time. I appreciate it so much. But before we go, perhaps you can tell us what projects are up next for you.
Sure. Yeah, I'm just on the early stages of a new project. I'm sticking with the issue of intelligence ethics, so ethical questions connected with the collection of intelligence. And I'm sticking with the troubles in Northern Ireland as well. But I'm looking at this time the allegations, the very wide range of allegations of collusion. So we're talking about the use of informers in the loyalist groups in Northern Ireland, the loyalist paramilitary and terrorist groups who were employed by the military and the police to provide intelligence. And the question that there was, there are all sorts of allegations of questionable treatment of the informers. For example, cases where it was suspected that an informer had been involved in a murder and that murder therefore was not investigated properly in order to protect that informer so that they would be able to carry on producing intelligence. So there's a whole range of issues about ethics and intelligence there that I'm starting to explore.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Samantha. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
You're very welcome.